The Shaggy Jenkins Show.
We have to make Russia great again.
On the Pacifica Radio Network.
It's the Shaggy Jenkins Show on the Pacifica Radio Network. Welcome to it. Boy, do we have a lot to cover today, including Rob Rosenstein out as Deputy Attorney General. Media coverage not so in with what it's done to Donald Trump. A smear campaign against Buttigieg, a weird kind of plot to kill people by an Army veteran, and so much more as we get into one of the weirdest weeks of news, well, thus far, and that's saying a lot. Before we get to all of that, some brief introductions are in line. Hi, I'm your host. My name is Shaggy Jenkins, critical thinker, problem solver, guy just left of normal insane, and always centered in common sense, and found at a website, ShaggyJenkins.com, or wherever fine social media is served, at Shaggy Live. We begin today with some sad news. John Singleton, a filmmaker who you probably remember from movies like Boys in the Hood and, well, dang near everything in the 1990s that seemed not so white and boring. Well, John Singleton has passed away at age 51. His family had made the decision to remove him from life support. And as of yesterday, in a statement from Cedar Cyanide, the director has passed away. Now, why is John Singleton so important? Well, back in the 1980s and 90s, of course, Hollywood was making films aplenty, but they weren't really that inclusive. Now, I know what you're thinking, but Shaggy, that's around the same time that Eddie Murphy was all over the screen. That's the time that we had a lot of black actors getting roles, including younger Denzel Washington and people of that nature. However, they didn't start getting roles of prominence up until John Singleton came along. The reason why is because Singleton and guys like Spike Lee were the first African-American descendant directors to hit the big time. And Boys in the Hood changed the way that we started talking about, well, stories from minority communities. I mean, you think about it, before that, it was kind of all West Side Story in white culture. But Singleton come along, and through his inspirational works and also testimony in front of a Senate subcommittee, changed the tone way back in the 1990s for more inclusion in Hollywood. So if you enjoy movies like Girls Trip, if you enjoy movies like Black Panther, just think that those movies would not have been possible had it not been for John Singleton coming through and breaking those doors down. Now, a lot of people would refer to him as an urban story maker. Some people would say that he's the guy that brought the black community to the screen in more real and raw sense that it's ever been, brought before. But in reality, he was a good storyteller, and his stories and his characters were very compelling, and he had a great style for delivering those to camera. So take a moment to remember one of the most groundbreaking and pioneering filmmakers of the latter 20th century, who, let's just face it, if there hadn't been him, well, we wouldn't be enjoying a lot of the cinema that we have now. From there, we move to some weirder news. Rob Rosenstein, he's the U.S. Deputy Attorney General. He's the one that was put in charge of the special counsel when Jeff Sessions recused himself. He has also been, like, kind of beaten up in public by Donald Trump, and has made a couple of, shall we say, clapbacky type statements to the president on his social media. Well, in a letter dated, yesterday, he's announcing that he'll be stepping down as of May 11th. Now, he paid tribute to Trump, even praising the president, saying that he liked the president's, quote, courtesy and humor. Okay. Remember that humor includes an image once of Rob Rosenstein in jail for treason that was put out on the president's Twitter account. Now, he was originally appointed by Republican George W. Bush, and he was expected to resign in March following the appointment of William Barr. But the Justice Department stayed on just a little bit longer to help Barr manage the, you know, public release that, by the way, is going swimmingly well. There is absolutely nothing to worry. Oh, God, who am I kidding? We'll get to that in a bit. But here's the thing. Rob Rosenstein endured attack after attack after attack under the president. And in just a sec, well, we'll talk about why that's kind of important. Because the Rosenstein story was the first kind of story where our public perception of the president and his administration started to change. Now, when I say it started to change, I mean it changes in big ways, huge ways. And the reason why is simple. We started looking at the president and his constant barrage against Rob Rosenstein, against the Mueller investigation, against Robert Mueller and every special prosecutor and person that cooperated with the special prosecution online time and time and time again, so much so that, dare I say, that I think that we all need to kind of take a step back and feel kind of bad for how we've treated this whole story. You see, for the longest time, Rosenstein has just been inundated from criticism, not just from the president, but from also the president's sycophants in his cabinet, as well as Mitch McConnell and some Republican senators. Rosenstein has been seen as almost, even in Lindsey Graham's eyes, as kind of an enemy of the state at times when he didn't seem to be going along with the pro-Trump agenda. And this has led to a lot of the media kind of looking at Rosenstein through this lens of, well, that's just the nature of being him. And that's where we kind of start to transition to another story that we need to talk about, which is the president and his behavior in general and the media's depiction of it. Because here's something that I would like to submit for your approval. If you look back at the timeline and the mainstream media coverage of the Rosenstein epic tale from the time that Trump became president to yesterday when he announced his resignation, look at the amount of punishment this guy has actually endured and how little coverage it gets as time goes on. It's something that we've done not only with Rosenstein, but with story after story in this Trump presidency. But I want to bring up Rosenstein in particular, because this is a glaring example of something that we have allowed to become normalized. Now, I know you probably hear that word from time to time and you're like, what does normalized actually mean? It means that you take some very aberrant, extremist type of behavior, you do it over and over and over again, and people stop getting shocked. People stop getting worried. The media stops talking about it. In other words, it falls back into the white noise of everyday life. It has become a normal part of your daily existence. And with the Rosenstein narrative, from beginning of Trump's presidency all the way till his resignation, the narrative has been that this is a guy that basically was kind of in the shadows, then brought to light after Jeff Sessions' amazing performance as Attorney General. And then has just been inundated with insults and through social media and in press conferences, has been called names time and time again. And as the investigation started drawing to a close, saw an escalation, not a de-escalation, not just kind of a, this is what it is on a daily basis, an escalation of attacks from the president himself. And yet now we're kind of sitting here and covering his resignation like, oh, well, I guess that happened. We've stopped looking into the terrible behavior by the White House. We've stopped seeing it as what it actually is, outside of the norms of American democracy. and damaging to the institutions that this country was founded and runs on. And we can also talk about how it's against the actual principles of the Constitution, but, oh, we don't have that much show. But Rob Rosenstein, and also Trump's latest rally, okay? Because let's talk about it. The one that he did from Wisconsin. That happened not too long ago, right? And when you look at the sound clip, and you look at the little tidbits of information that we put up from the president, I want you to consider them formulaic for a second. That means that they're all going to follow a certain narrative. That narrative is, president holds rally. People show up to rally. President says, quote, extreme thing. And then they move on to the next story. You see, time and time again, we forget that this is a president that, at least according to CNN, has racked up some 10,000 lies while in office. Some of those lies having to do with policy. Some of those lies having to do with, well, immigrants and actual people, minorities, women. And in the case of the Green Bay rally, the latest sound bit that we got was, oh, the president said that women and doctors sit back and decide if they're going to kill the kid after it's born. Now, we all know what an extremely false statement that is. And if you do not know that that statement is false, it is false. There, somebody has told you. But you can also look it up online. Infanticide is not a thing allowed in any state of the United States, which is vis-a-vis America. Okay, there. I think I have taken that down to the lowest common denominator that we possibly can. It's a falsehood. But instead of getting riled up, instead of going through the actual ways that this statement is a lie, of covering the just decades of history of misogynistic male behavior towards female reproductive rights, and how Donald Trump is going into a scary narrative that could take away a lot more than women appreciate, including coverage for certain things under their health care plans. Instead of going down that route, we say, oh, Donald Trump said something's crazy, and boom, we're on to the next sound clip. Here's the president doing something crazy. Here's the president saying something crazy. Here's the president at a rally in front of thousands and thousands of people and them not coming up in arms at the fact that he's making a blatant lie in front of them. There's no hoopla. There's no big whoop-de-doo made about it. The president got in front of thousands of people, told a bunch of crazily scary lies that have dangerous consequences for women in this country. And next clip, please. Here's Tom with the weather. Whatever you want to say, look, the fact of the matter remains. We've started as the mainstream media to normalize the president's terrible, terrible behavior, and we have to put a stop to it. And the reason why we have to put a stop to it is evident in the rise of hate crimes, not just here in the United States, but also in other places around the world, like the New Zealand Christchurch incident, where the shooter did indeed cite the rhetoric of Donald Trump as partially inspiration for what, well, transpired. And the thing that we do time and time again now, that we used to not do with any other president before, is we just go for the highlights. We only look for the craziest, scariest things that the president does, or the wackiest public statements that he makes, put those into a sound bit, play them over and over again, and then we move on. But instead of doing that, media, mainstream media, journalism, has to come back to the fold and start being a lot more responsible with the president. including when we have statements like he made in Green Bay, when he's in front of a room of people and he says that, you know what, the FBI, the Justice Department, the intelligence community of the United States are scum. The people that do news are sick. And you know what? Taking immigrants and forcing them to go to places that have opposed my policies was, quote, actually my sick idea. It is 2019, and what does this crowd start doing? Chanting, lock her up, referring to Hillary Clinton, who is, once again, nowhere near Donald Trump these days. I mean, honestly, that's beating a dead horse at this point, but they still do it. But time and time and time again, instead of focusing on these narratives of why is this lock her up thing so resonating? Why do they say things like CNN sucks? Why do they get up there and time and time and time again believe the president when he says outlandish lie? Instead of doing that, we take the sound clip, we cover the main narrative, and boom, we have moved on. But it's time for the media to start being a lot more responsible with covering this president. Because never in a time in history have we been at a place where so many weird things are happening to the institutions of American democracy all at once. All being orchestrated around one cult of personality of a president. Who, let's just go ahead and say, has no discernible political understanding of how his office functions. Time and time again, he has made oversteps to what the president can actually do, what the president can't do, how unilaterally he can act versus what the Constitution actually says. The latest thing is that he and William Barr are kind of setting up this whole debate about whether or not they're even going to answer questions anymore. And that, in its essence, isn't just another Trump crazy thing. We have to just stop labeling events like this that are constitutionally trying crises as mundane. We have to stop normalizing the abnormal Trump presidency. And when it comes to the coverage of this week of how everybody in, and especially the talking heads, are getting on the airwaves and talking about, well, you know, this is what's happening with William Barr and the House and blah, blah, blah. And it's all going to be very formulaic. We're just going to say, well, they're doing this. And yeah, we expect them to do this. Lindsey Graham making statements that the president should fight congressional subpoenas, quote, like hell. You have somebody in an Article 1 body of government, according to our Constitution, condoning and, in fact, kind of escalating the antics of an out-of-control executive branch. Which, by the way, let's back this up here, talking about the Constitution. Congress's job is to keep the executive branch in check and vice versa. That's why we have three co-equal branches of government. Not co-equal anymore, since Republicans under Donald Trump have started going much more unilaterally towards nationalism, something that the United States has, let's just be honest, flirted with in the past, but never really dove both feet into like we do in modern times. But once again, it's just another crazy thing. And that's where the media is being very irresponsible. These are not crazy things. These are systematic corrosions and attacks on the principles and institutions of the American governmental system. These are constitutional crises. These are overreaches of power. These are outright fabrications merely for propaganda use We have lie after lie after lie uttered by a sitting president who is creating a divisive polarization of the American electorate. We're no longer about compromise. We're no longer about working together for a better tomorrow. Where I'm right and they're wrong. And that's where we're wrong. We being, well, me and you. Not just the media, just me and you are wrong. Because we've allowed the stories to become soundbites. We've allowed the antics to become mundane. We've allowed the assaults on our democracy to be news at 11. And, oh, isn't that crazy? Or, oh, I'm so disturbed and I'm back in bed. Until we're, like, back for the next cycle. A comedian that I used to listen to described a fascination once. His name was Bill Hicks, by the way, and he described people's fascination with painful things, equating watching the dissolution of the American democracy to touching a sore tooth. You've had it before, right? That one tooth that's kind of sore that you haven't seen the dentist for yet, and you know you shouldn't mess with it, but there you are, poking at it time and time again, like, ow, 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 why does this hurt? Because you keep poking it. And after a while, even though it's painful, and even though it's something you should not do, you just do it. It becomes a thing. You've normalized, essentially, torturing yourself. And that's kind of the same sick way that you can describe what the media has done to Donald Trump. We've gone beyond the facet of just saying, well, this is odd, to just saying, hey, here's something odd, and kind of just letting that thing exist and moving on. Not in anywhere in the United States history of journalism do you find a more lax approach to a more controversial public figure than this. And I know what you're thinking, but Shaggy, if I turn on MSNBC, if I turn on CNN, if I turn on any of these stations, if I turn on Fox News, it's all about the president and the political climate, and how dare you say that we're not doing a good job of looking into this? We're not. Because what we're doing is we're just taking crazy for crazy's sake and moving on. We're merely reporting the words, not the ramifications. We're not looking into the background of some of these crazy, outlandish, conspiratorial things that the president says. How did they come across his desk? Is he hashing these up himself? Where did he get this idea that doctors and women in Wisconsin plan after birth whether or not they're going to kill the kid? Infanticide. Killing a baby is illegal, but the president doesn't think so. Where did he learn that? We don't question anymore. We don't dig anymore. We don't, dare I say it, research enough anymore. We allow things to come from the president and to be crazy and to exist in their own right as just crazy, isolated things. But it's not isolated incidences that we can just pop up and say, here's a sound bit of our president being crazy. Now let's move on to sports. We can't do that. That is irresponsible of the media. Yes, the president lies. We need to say that all the time. We need to say that as well. The president lies all the time. Here's a lie. And we're not going to just move on to another sound bit. We're going to take the time as responsible journalists to do what journalism is supposed to do and provide context. This is why what he said was wrong. This is the legal definition of the things that he said, which, by the way, are wrong. And this is where we think the president got the idea for that story. These are the people that are actually corrupting the democracy by getting into the president's head and putting these thoughts in there. Or our president just makes this stuff up on the cuff because, as a quote-unquote deal maker, having a good catchy story to inspire people is just his way of doing business, and we should ignore those statements because it is just hyperbole meant for political posturizing. But no, Donald Trump says something crazy, media kind of says, here's the sound clip, look, the president did something again, and then we move on. That's going to get us into a lot of trouble in the future. And not just as the media is concerned, because let's not forget, unless some drastic things happen, the tenure of this president is only going to be confined to hopefully one term, but maybe two. And after that, we'll have another president that we'll have to hold accountable for more kind of crazy shenanigans. And if we are going to get in the habit of the United States media of just normalizing somebody that goes so against the principles of this country that it just becomes a crazy thing versus a crisis, which is what it actually is, then I'm just going to go ahead and say it. We're in real trouble. Coming up, we'll talk about some smear campaigns and more real trouble Trump might find himself into. It's next, The Shaggy Jenkins Show.
Is the Shaggy Jenkins Show on the Pacifica Radio Network.
It's the Shaggy Jenkins Show on the Pacifica Radio Network. Welcome back to it. Oh boy, do we have a lot to cover today. And if you missed any of the things that we covered at the first half of the show, well, I'm kind of easy to find. Go to my website, shaggyjenkins.com, or wherever your podcasting preferences are. Look for the Shaggy Jenkins Show. We're on a lot of different platforms and pretty easy to find. Hi, I'm your host, and before the break, we were talking a little bit how the media is being very irresponsible with kind of ignoring the escalations of craziness from the president. Well, I'm going to switch from that to a story I found on the Daily Beast, which, let's just be honest, is crazy, but once again, is in danger of being normalized. Now, you're going to have to follow me here real quickly, because if you only listen to the first part of this explanation and not the second part, then you're about to get very angry. The weirdness of the Me Too movement has been the systematic way of accusing somebody of sexual assault or some sort of sexual harassment. The go-to way of bringing down someone political. And that has had devastating consequences for the actual sexual assault victims in this country. You see what I mean? You hear the first half and you're like, oh God, Shaggy's saying that the Me Too movement just calls people to blame each other for sexual harassment because it's convenient. Yeah, I did. But then I also clarified that by letting you know, no, that doesn't mean that the Me Too movement isn't somehow illegitimate movement. That means that, no, once again, we're missing the point in the media. This is the thing. Now, with all of the coverage behind all of the Me Too, well, everything, really, producers, actors, Kevin Spacey story, everything that you can imagine that came out as that movement. People have seen that as a go-to way of making sure that because the fires are stoked in our society against that kind of behavior, that the easiest way to take somebody down is just to throw them in front of the bullseye, whether or not they legitimately belong there. And once again, for people that are actually coming forward with legitimate stories of sexual assault and harassment, This muddies the water and makes it harder for us to give the proper respect to an actual legitimate claim of sexual assault. And this is the thing. Most of the time when you hear stories like somebody was going to use sexual assault to take somebody down politically, usually when you hear that, it's sad but true. They're mostly conservatives. And that's kind of the weird case that Pete Buttigieg found himself into. A pair of right-wing provocateurs, according to the Daily Beast, Jack Berkman and Jacob Wall, had kind of approached this guy, a Republican, and said, look, we need you to come forward and falsely accuse Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, of engaging him sexually while he was too drunk to consent. Now, according to the Daily Beast, this anonymous source came forward and said that their goal, as explained to him, was to kneecap Buttigieg's momentum. I think I said that correct. In the upcoming presidential race. Now, of course, the Daily Beast says the man has to remain anonymous because the, you know, publicity could make his employment kind of a thing of the past, and because Wall and Berkman have a reputation for vindictiveness. But this is the thing. He also provided an audio recording of the meeting, which kind of collaborates his account. In it, Wall, who's, let's just be honest, known for being an internet troll, says that Buttigieg was a terminal threat to Donald Trump's re-election. Now, Berkman or Wall hasn't responded publicly to anything around this story, but I want you to consider this just for a second. One of the things that is happening in America right now is that even before a candidate has been declared from a political party, people on their own behest are seeking to do dirty politics. Now, whether or not these are orchestrated from some sort of centralized network or, you know, the Russians, it remains to be seen. But in this country right now, we are so wanting our politicians to remain in power that we are willing to do some pretty unscrupulous, crazy things. And I'm not going to do the irresponsible media thing I was talking about in the first half of the program. I'm actually going to cover why this is an important story. You see, when these far right-wing groups and these, what they call themselves, provocateurs of conservatism, do these kind of things, they take away from legitimate stories that have actual social relevance. And going after somebody and accusing them of sexual assault, knowing that right now in this country there is an awakening of society to the fact that rampant sexism exists and harassment and assault is just something that as a woman in this country, you're told to just deal with. And that, sick reality. Instead of coming to light with all of that stuff and saying, you know what, maybe we need to approach things with a little bit more sensitivity. No. Hey, this looks like an easy way to get somebody in trouble. And you know what? Let's do it. And more cases like this show up, the more it delegitimizes the actual assault victim. But the media won't talk so much about that. They'll talk about how Buttigieg is a rising candidate within the DNC, that if elected, he would be the first married gay man to ever occupy the post, that his husband would be the first man of the United States. And hey, with a name like, you know, Chasen, I think his name is, he's adorable. It would kind of be kind of a cute story to have as far as a country that's coming to terms with society has changed and so must we. But instead, the narrative is going to be, well, no, we won't let that victory happen in a straight-ahead kind of way. we have to engage in these smear tactics and these terribly devastating accusations of somebody, that the more we make those accusations actually demeans real victims. We're prepared to go down that path. And that's where the Me Too movement is always going to struggle. When stories like this comes out, all of a sudden, every attack against somebody of prominence is a smear campaign. Not an individual complaint against somebody's character, which we should examine in an individual case-by-case basis. We can't just say everybody accused of it has done it and everybody that's accused of it did not do it. We can't do that. But we have to have the wherewithal, the common sense, and I hate to say this, but the societal fortitude to kind of have the spine to say, no, this is a serious issue that we must deal with. And people that use it to some sort of political advantage try to turn it into just another operation of the trade that delegitimize real victims. We have to go against them loudly. And we have to make sure that the narrative isn't forgot. A sexual assault, sexual harassment is a daily reality for a lot of people in their workplace. And some of those people feel so disenfranchised, so powerless, that they can't come forward in a safe environment and say, I have been sexually assaulted, I have been sexually harassed. The more stories that come out about people trying to use sexual harassment and sexual assault as a political tool, the less likely we are to seek justice in this country for actual victims. And speaking of actual victims, we're moving on to our next story that could have had a lot of victims. A United States Army veteran was kind of arrested recently in the final stages of what was supposed to be a massive assault. Now, usually when we talk about U.S. Army veterans, we're like, oh, yeah, this is a, you know, white supremacist. But in this case, no. It's a Muslim convert, age 26. He plotted an attack on Jews, churches, and police for the revenge and retaliation for the racist attacks in New Zealand. Now, asking yourself, why would a United States former Army veteran want to retaliate against an act that happened in New Zealand? Let's not forget, the Christchurch incident in New Zealand was a white man with white supremacist thoughts who directly referenced the President of the United States and the rising tide of white nationalism in this country as inspiration for his heinous act. So, I ask again, why would someone in the United States plan to do a retaliation for an attack that happened in New Zealand? Because we birthed the New Zealand massacre. We did that. But Mark Domingo, age 26, who showed support for a violent jihad during the whole course of this planning, was basically taking steps to bomb a Nazi rally. Now, I know what you're thinking. Wouldn't that be a good thing? And then I say to you, what point do we start looking at the value of human life again? But the thing is that federal prosecutors acting along with local enforcement and people within the deeper intelligence community were able to kind of track this guy down before he was able to enact the attack. Now, he considered other targets other than Nazis too, including Jewish people, churches of just the Christian faith, and random police officers before setting his sights down on a Long Beach kind of far-right group that had planned to march on Sunday. Now, of course, they didn't go up. Anti-racism counter-demonstrators did. But the idea from Domingo's old stance was, you know what? I'm going to show up there, and then I'm just going to start killing a lot of people. And here's the thing. He did show up on scene. He did have an AK-47. He did say that he was serious when he had met with investigators earlier. So when you want to talk about something that was about to happen, this was a very real and scary threat. He even posted online, quote, "America needs another Vegas event to give them a taste of the terror they gladly spread all over the world." Our political climate is now radicalizing people. The fact that our president, once again, gets up there and basically says things like, hey, my statement about white nationalists being good people on both sides, that was a perfect response. Kellyanne Conway, the president's near-perfect response to nationalism and Nazis' rise in this country. Everything's fine. You guys have got it all wrong. Time and time again, people are seeing that behavior and saying, well, if they're going to radicalize white nationalists, I'm going to radicalize myself. And in the case of Domingo, that's exactly what happened. Now, if you want to hear how heinous this attack was going to be, Domingo had planned some explosives. And those explosives were, let's just say, reminiscent of the ones that some young Muslim terrorists put at the Boston Marathon not too many years ago. And Domingo said that he had actually sought out, specifically in hardware stores, a 3-inch nail, because he knows that that's long enough to penetrate the human body and puncture internal organs from a shrapnel perspective. Small, fast, they ride the percussion wave out and do massive amounts of bodily damage, shredding people's organs. But when time come to do the plan, instead of enacting a terrible scene of death, federal investigators were actually able to stage an arrest that saved a lot of lives. But think about this. In the United States, when we talk about terrorism, we need to talk about the terrorism that our president is inspiring around the world and how that terrorism can be inspired domestically. Like, take for instance this whole incident in San Diego where a synagogue was attacked. 19-year-old John Ernest kind of went in there and perpetuated a horrible travesty again. Now, of course, his parents have come out and said that, you know, look, he's evil. He's, quote, a part of the history of evil, perpetuated on the Jewish people. They said they were shocked and deeply saddened. But the thing is their statements didn't say the thing that none of us are saying. Are we surprised? No. Because here's the deal. Once again, we have a young man inspired to nationalism and basically saying, hey, now is the time to strike. We are in the right political climate for this. Why would he have a thought like that? Why does anybody in this country have thoughts like that? Well, it comes from the very top. A president that's not only xenophobic, misogynistic, and let's just be honest, really kind of has a thing against immigrants. I mean, look at this. In a memo he recently put out, he's announced some very big changes to the United States asylum process. Keep in mind, seeking asylum in the United States is not a crime. Now, here's the thing. The measures that he's including require a fee for asylum applications, work permit applications, barring migrants who are entered or attempted to enter the United States illegally from getting work authorization before any relief or protection is granted. Oh, and he also says that, you know, asylum applications have to be adjudicated within 180 days of filing. In other words, this is taking a very, very surgical aim, almost laser-like aim, at migrants seeking asylum. It makes the process too hard for most people that would actually need political asylum to obtain. Now, this is the thing. Trump has time and time and time again said that this country has a broken immigration system. So broken, in fact, that he forgot his dad was born in New York and instead said he was born in Germany. He wasn't. But moving on. The Department of Homeland Security has came out and said, you know what, there's been a 2,000% increase in migrants claiming credible fear, which is credible fear, you know, fear of losing your life, is a first step in the asylum process. And they say that over the last 5 years, that's jumped up 2,000%. But the thing is this measure doesn't do anything to address why all of these migrants have a credible fear to claim. No, it slaps a fee on their application. It keeps some of them from working legally in the United States. It makes the application process almost unattainable. It also notes that work authorization is going to be stripped from migrants who are denied asylum or subject to a final order of removal. Now, it also goes on to say the Attorney General and Homeland Security Secretary are to take actions within 90 days of this memo, even though the Department of Justice oversees the immigration court. But time and time and time again, the president has made just terrible conditions for people trying to come into this country. He's proposed a border wall. He's said to lock up massively anybody suspected of being illegal. You know, what is it? Deport first, trial later. Mitch McConnell has done a very good job of behind the scenes loading the immigration courts with conservative judges. Judges that are responsible for seeing up to 1,500 cases in a day. Do you think that they are actually going to do anything other than say, deport next, deport next, deport next, deport next? No, they're not going to. They have no incentive to. And this new memo coming out from the president, if enacted, could basically make it that much tougher. Now, for a country that has a rich, rich history of immigration, including, well, I mean, look around. Not all of us are native to these lands, especially where I am in the 50th state of Hawaii. Look around. We all got here somehow. That process was immigration. A lot of us came probably from relatives that in the late 19th century, early 20th century, came here seeking political asylum and even credible fear in the European wars that were to hatch called World War I and II. Immigration played a role in the growth of America, and this president seems dead set to slam the door shut on all of it. Now, this is the thing, though. The events that the president say precipitate this type of drastic action. Well, once again, we've gone without saying, but now we have to say it more and more until people understand the situation that he's talking about does not exist in the extremes that he mentions. A lot of his facts about the threat from the southern border is fake. It's made up. It's rumor. It's hyperbole. It's propaganda. And now with this memo, the president is hoping that we as a country have bought into his act, that we've gotten comfortable with accepting the things that he says as truth. There is a crisis on the southern border. There is a migrant caravan. There are Taliban and Al-Qaeda and terrorists in there. There's MI-13 and rapers and stabbers and junkies, and they're going to come and give us all kinds of diseases. We have to go and believe every word of Donald Trump so that when he comes out with a memo like this, we're like, yes, good job, Mr. President, in protecting this country. That's what he needs from his base. That's what he needs from his support to make this happen. Absolute, unshakable faith in the narrative that he has laid out ahead of this. And I hate to say, not the truth. And when he gets into the memo and he says, quote, that emergency continues to grow increasingly severe. He's talking about, you know, the national emergency declaration that he said he was going to do so that he could get around Congress and get money to build his wall. He goes, that crisis that I used, that emergency, well, that's continuing to grow. There was never an emergency in the first place. There was never any threat to begin with. It was made up. But because he's put that made-up thing out there, he's using foundational narrative skills. He's put something out there in the narrative that's been foundational. It's established the next part of the book, the second act of the movie, as it were. And now with us deeply ensconced in the second act, it's time to go to the third act. And that third act is going to be, oh, the hero rises with a memo that saves everybody, and he's willing to claim this as a huge victory going into 2020. That's what they want to happen. But face facts. The facts of the matter will not let that happen. We know that violent immigration is really kind of a myth. We know that immigrants actually contribute to the growing and swelling of a gross domestic product of a country. But what we don't know is why Donald Trump chooses to lie. We'll have to save that for another show. Till next time.